Hello, Beat Check listeners. I'm Gosia Wozniacka, and I'm the environmental justice reporter at The Oregonian. Today, I'm with Bob Jenks, executive director of the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, also known as the Oregon CUB. It's an organization that advocates for utility customers. And we're going to be talking about the significant rate increases that many PGE, Pacific Power, and Northwest Natural customers have seen in recent months. We'll talk about why those rate hikes are so large, what the future of utility rates is, and how our transition to electric and climate change are impacting utilities. So let's get started. Lots of important topics there. Welcome to the show, Bob. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
So before we get started on the rate hikes, can you just very briefly describe CUB's work?
Yes. We're an independent nonprofit that represents utility customers. We were formed in 1984 because at that time, Oregon was one of just a handful of states that had no advocate working on behalf of customers. And we go before regulators, the regulators that set rates and supposed to protect customers. But if they don't hear from somebody on the side of customers, if they only hear from utilities, it's really hard for regulators to protect customers and act in our best interests. So we are established to represent those interests before the legislature and state regulators. We have a team of lawyers and economists who dig into utility rate requests and into utility policies to find out if things are really in the best interest of customers. And we look for alternatives. When PGE wanted to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on retrofitting the Boardman coal plant, we looked at it and said no and pushed them to look at an analysis that would phase it out and close it in 2020 and found that doing that would save customers about $200 million. But if somebody didn't step in and demand that that was examined as an option, quite frankly, we wouldn't have been able to get there.
Well, that's great that you're able to represent customers and ask the utilities to perhaps make some changes in their proposal. So let's talk about those rate hikes. Customers of investor-owned utilities in Oregon have seen steep rate increases recently, and more increases are in the works. PGE recently saw 18% increase, and over the past 2 years, 30% cumulative increase. Pacific Power saw their bills go up by 21% in 2023 and another 12% in 2024. And Pacific Power just filed for another increase, 17% for residential customers. And Idaho Power is asking for a 27% rate increase for Eastern Oregon customers. So those are some pretty steep increases. Why are they happening?
Right. There's a variety of factors, and there is some truth that there's general inflation, just as things at the supermarket, a lot of prices have gone up, a lot of things utilities buy, prices have gone up. Steel, for example, is up more than 200% since 2020, and their salaries are going up. There were supply chain issues coming out of COVID, things like line transformers and utility meters suddenly didn't have enough supply, and that shot prices up. The wildfires that we've been having and been exposed to, I mean, utilities are spending, the two big utilities are spending more than $1 billion on hardening their system to protect from wildfires, and Pacific Power has huge wildfire liability. Capital investment in new transmission lines and batteries add costs. Load growth is a large part of what's driving that. The big server farms are causing them to have to add generation to their system. And of course, utilities always want to take advantage of any kind of rate increases to say, oh yeah, let's increase officer salaries, let's increase shareholder profits, and things like that. So anytime there's an opportunity to raise rates, they want to make sure that they're getting in on the additional money also.
Mm-hmm. So many, many different reasons. And we're going to unpack a few of them later in the show. So one thing I did want to ask, rate increases obviously are a mechanism for the utility to recover costs and also to make some money for its shareholders. But why do customers have to pay for business costs versus investors? Like, why do customers have to pay for wildfire mitigation or, you know, for clean energy things? Is there a general rate of return that PUC allows and that beyond that, utilities can't ask for more?
Yeah, there's really two types of utilities out there. There's nonprofit consumer-owned utilities, and there's for-profit or investor-owned utilities. For-profit utilities are monopolies, and to prevent them from taking advantage of customers, they're rate regulated. by law, the regulator, in this case, the Public Utility Commission, the PUC, is supposed to allow them the opportunity to earn a reasonable return. Now, the definition is reasonable return, reasonable profits. And in Oregon, our gas utilities are all for profit, our electric utilities are mostly for profit, and our water utilities are almost all nonprofit and run by local governments. And so the for-profit utilities, again, they get to earn a profit margin, and they're always wanting to. One of the things I've learned in decades of doing this is utilities always want higher profit margins for their investors, and they always want less risk for their investors. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Why should I be giving you a higher profit for taking less risk? But that's the way the system sort of works right now.
What is a reasonable profit? Is it like a percentage or?
Yeah, normally the way you think about that is it's comparable to other companies, other businesses with comparable risk. Normally they look at other utilities out there and you think about it in terms of a reasonable range. There's not a single point that is a reasonable return that if you're a little bit below that, you need to raise rates. So you can think of it as a range, say between a 9 and 10% return on equity. And equity is the amount of equity investment that shareholders have in the utility. So you have that reasonable range, and the commission's supposed to be trying to sort of land the rate case with the utility's earnings in that reasonable range. One of the things we're going to be advocating for this year with these big rate increases is the commission said itself to the legislature that one of the ways it can help control large rate increases and respond to them is by setting the profit margins at the lowest level that is meets that legal definition of reasonableness. So we're going to be asking the commission to move utility profit margins not to the not establish them at the midpoint of a reasonable range, but set them at the lowest place that is reasonably that is legally meets that definition of reasonableness. And that sends a message to utilities that your big rate hikes, not controlling your costs, are going to affect the profit margins that your shareholders are going to get. And we'll send, I think, a powerful message to them that they need to start to control their costs.
You mentioned multiple reasons for why utilities raise rates in addition to trying to make money for their shareholders. Things like inflation, wildfire mitigation, cost of adding new clean energy projects and transmission into the grid. And so I want to unpack a few of those because I think they're all really important. And maybe let's start with the wildfires, since there is a lot of litigation around that. It's an area where all of the utilities, or most of the utilities, the electric ones, are asking for a lot of money. And just to clarify, wildfire management means tree trimming, vegetation removal in areas that are prone to wildfires. Why are utilities spending so much money on lessening wildfire risks and asking customers to pay that bill?
Yeah, no, the climate change has changed Oregon. And across the West has changed the climate. Our forests exist in a climate that's hotter and drier than the trees evolved in. And that means that they're very prone to wildfires, particularly in late summer where we have these long, hot summers and that are dry. You add a little bit of wind to those, or a significant amount of wind. And utility lines, when they touch trees, can catch on fire. And so you've got a problem where we're seeing across the West fires created by utility equipment because of the forests are so much different than they used to be. And that's drives the one of the things we found is it's very clear that a jury will hold the utility accountable. A jury will say, if you didn't shut off power, if you had the opportunity, if you knew the weather event was coming, if you knew the wind was going to be blowing strongly in a dry forest and you didn't turn off the power to that line, you're liable for the damage. You're liable for those communities that burned. Suddenly, we're seeing utilities facing bankruptcy because of wildfire liability. That creates a big motivation to prevent that. So utilities have turned around and are investing huge amounts of money, billions of dollars, into wildfire mitigation. That does mean things like vegetation management, cutting down vegetation near the power lines. It means covering lines so we don't have bare lines in forested areas. It means a lot more sort of automatic circuits that shut off automatically when there's disruptions, and get rid of the things that turn on automatically when those things get cleared, better weather, micro weather reporting from all over their system, so they're better monitoring it and getting feedback instantly from their system and know what's going on. So there's a lot of investment that they're trying to make to prevent those wildfires, because their systems are really, really dangerous in the environment and in the climate that we have today.
And I should add that utilities pretty much across the West face billions in damages over their failure to prepare, leading to catastrophic wildfires, including Pacific Power in Oregon, and also utilities in California, Hawaii, and Colorado. So this is becoming a big issue across the West. Should ratepayers bear the damages awarded to wildfire victims, or should shareholders?
Right. No, that's going to become a big issue. That's the biggest driver of the Pacific Core rate case. They have a rate case that the residential increase part is more than 20% now, and over half of that rate case is wildfires, wildfire related. Some of it is cost of mitigation. A large part of it is this wildfire, catastrophic wildfire fund, which is really a liability fund. Let's be honest, this is to cover the liability from the Labor Day fires and any fires that their systems have caused beyond that. One of the big questions is, should customers pay for this? A jury in Oregon found the company was grossly negligent and reckless. Utility rate making is done on a just and reasonable basis. Rates are supposed to be just and reasonable. We look at cost for prudency, have a prudency standard to determine what's just and reasonable. It's hard to reconcile a prudency standard with recklessness, with gross negligence. So there's a fundamental question whether it's legal to charge customers for those damages, as well as if a court puts punitive damages on a company, and that company is just allowed by regulators to pass those punitive damages on to customers, who's being punished? What's the purpose? What's the mechanism? So those are really, really serious issues. Again, the company's asking for those costs to be broadly put on customers. We're going to be pushing back and saying, no, the shareholders need to step up. Let's be honest, we can't fully protect customers from the costs of these things. The wildfire costs, the liability costs are causing insurance rates to go up. They're raising the cost of capital because to borrow money, the utilities are a greater credit risk. If a utility goes into bankruptcy from these costs, it stops making investments. There's all kinds of financial consequences throughout the utility for that some of them get passed through to customers. So we can say why it's okay, and we can say we shouldn't be charging customers for gross negligence and reckless. A utility that is grossly negligent and reckless with its system is going to inherently having costs come due to it that are going to flow through the customers. You can't insulate customers from a poorly managed utility that's acting irresponsibly.
And it sounds like we're going to be struggling with those issues more and more as the climate gets drier and wildfires become more frequent. I want to move on to another issue that is something that we're going to be struggling with for many, many years, which is the clean energy transition. As you mentioned, one of the costs that utilities try to recover as part of the rate cases is the cost of adding new clean energy or transmission into the grid. Oregon law requires PGE and Pacific Power to reduce their carbon emissions by 80% by 2030 and by 100% by 2040. So this means the utilities have to get rid of coal, natural gas, and rely 100% on clean, renewable energy by 2040. Pretty tall feat. So the utilities are spending a lot more on new transmission lines, wind turbines, solar farms, battery storage projects, all in their hope to reduce emissions. And so Oregonians are very supportive, I think, in general, of this transition. We all want to, you know, help reduce our contribution to climate change. But how much is this transition going to cost customers of utilities. You know, this is significant investments that the utilities need to make to reach these state mandates. How much is this going to cost?
Yeah, no, and that's, I think, an important question and an important thing to think about. And I think the first thing is to recognize that because we're in a transition to clean energy and utility rates are going up, people tend to connect the two and say one is caused by the other. Idaho Power has a 27% rate increase before the PUC for residential customers. They're not subject to a clean energy law here in Oregon, and Idaho doesn't have clean energy laws. So that's not what's driving their rate increase. PacifiCorp is still 50% coal. They've got a 20% rate increase before the Commission for Residential Customers, and it's being driven by wildfires, which are caused by climate change. It's not responding to climate change. It's the fact that the climate is changing that's causing those increases. So there are definitely lots of new investments we need to make. Some of them will push up rates. Some of the capacity costs, batteries, things like that, do put upward pressure on rates. Other investments can actually lower rates. PGE is this year brought on a new wind farm in Montana. That wind farm, from day one, is lowering rates. The capital costs, the investment costs of that are all being put into rates. But because there's no fuel costs associated with that, and it's knocking out purchase power costs, which are more expensive. And there's a bunch of tax credits from the federal government. The overall impact of that new investment is to lower rates, not to increase rates. When we closed the Boardman power plant as an alternative to retrofitting it, that saved customers $200 million. Natural gas rates went up 40%. They came down a little bit this year. They went up 40% the 2 years before that. So there's lots of things that are causing utility rates to go up. Some, like battery storage, relate to clean energy. Other ones, like coal and natural gas costs, which have both gone up dramatically in the last few years, are unrelated to climate change. In fact, responding with clean energy will reduce some of those costs. So I think we have to recognize that utility rates are going up. Some of what's driving rates up is increases in electric demand. Server farms are going in throughout Oregon and in a lot of utilities territories. Those are big demands on the system, and they have to go out and purchase power and build transmission and build the system to do that. That's pushing up rates. Part of what's happening with Idaho Power customers in Eastern Oregon is there's been tremendous load growth in Idaho, including some big new customers coming on that the utility has to suddenly go out and serve. Now, the territory in Eastern Oregon hasn't grown. Only 500 new customers have been added in Eastern Oregon to Idaho Power Service territory in the last decade. But because the system is growing and incurring additional costs, those are really being spread throughout the territory. So there's a bunch of different factors. Investing in clean energy does do some upward pressure on rates. Getting out of coal can lower rates, and so we have to be we just have to be a little bit careful about assuming that the clean energy is the cause of all these rate increases.
Got it. Yeah, and I wasn't suggesting that it was the entire cause, that it was one of the pieces of the pie. One of the things with wind and solar power is that they are not always reliable sources of energy. For example, during the ice storm in January that we all still remember, we got pretty much no power from wind or solar. And battery storage, which a lot of utilities like to point to as a savior, is still a pretty nascent idea. It's very new. There isn't a lot of battery storage around the state. So is this a concern that you know, are these goals realistic? We can add a lot of more wind and a lot more solar, but if they're not reliable, if they're not giving us the power in those sort of critical extreme weather moments when we need it the most, is this a concern for the future when we're going to be relying pretty much on clean energy 100% of the time?
Yes, there is a concern, and it's a concern that I think is solvable, though, again, Oregon built flexibility into the clean energy law. So if there's reliability constraints, if we can't solve some of these problems, then we can allow there's allowances to deal with that. So, but what we need is, first of all, is a diversity. That Montana wind that PGE is bringing into their system this year, when the gorge wind isn't blowing, the Montana wind likely is. The wind blows more often in Montana. A windmill in Montana will produce more wind than a windmill in the Columbia Gorge, and it blows at a different time. So that's a good resource. You're right. Batteries have an important role. They do great for summer, where the summer peak is just after the sun goes down, and they can take solar power from 1 p.m. in the afternoon when there's an excess and move it to 9 o'clock at night where people are still running their air conditioners. So batteries do a lot in the summer. In the winter, where you may have wind not blowing for 2 or 3 days, batteries we need more than batteries. And there I do think things like Rocky Mountain wind, offshore wind may be a good resource. There's a lot of work going on in long duration storage. There's capacity in our hydro system that we don't utilize as effectively as we could. So there does need to be some changes. I think when the 100% clean law passed, we recognized that we had a pretty good handle on getting to somewhere in the 85-90% range, but that last little bit was going to be a bit of a challenge. But we gave ourselves 20 years to figure it out, and gave off ramps and things in case we can't. So there are some challenges there, but I also think it's important to recognize that there are constraints on the energy system. And clean energy isn't the only problem there. You mentioned the ice storm. During the ice storm, the biggest threat to our energy systems in the Northwest was the Jackson Prairie natural gas storage facility in Washington State went down. Suddenly, gas customers in one of the coldest weeks were being asked to cut back on demand. Their electric utilities were worried about whether they could get enough gas to run their peaking units to supply gas. So our fossil fuel systems are also really vulnerable and are stressed out. And some of the problem is our demand and supply and transmission, all the parts of our system are just so constrained. We're closer to the edge than we would like to be in reliability, it can be a dangerous place. But it's not just renewable systems; our fossil fuel systems are also pretty stressed. And if they go down, we're going to see problems in the Northwest like they've seen in other parts of the country.
And so what I'm hearing you say is that part of the answer is to diversify the sources of our energy and then expand the system so that it's not as stressed and stretched to the limit?
Yes, we need to diversify the system. We need to expand the system. We need to bring in sort of new things like demand response, where we can actually work with customers to lower demand at key times, and your EV will automatically change its charging if there's too much demand on the grid and things like that. So there's a bunch of things that I think we need to do that. Diversifying resources is important. And then we need some technological innovation on long-term storage. Would help getting over the hump on how do you do floating offshore wind in North America. I mean, so there's innovations that are out there that everyone says is likely. There's new technology for geothermal that could produce great resources in the Western United States. So all of those things, there's lots and lots of people working on all those challenges. And the fact that we don't have all the answers today, to me, doesn't worry me as much, quite frankly, as the fact that there's just too much stuff going on. So
by too much stuff, what do you mean?
I mean, just too much demand. We're growing too fast. All the server farms going on. It's like you think we have this figured out, and then suddenly we realize, wait, we're growing 9% per year, and that hasn't happened since the 1960s. Suddenly there's changes in our system that are happening much more rapidly than we thought. The changes in our forests and wildfires. We didn't think wildfires were such a big problem, in the Northwest until just a few years ago. So it's not, it's the problems that we anticipated with the need to diversify and bring in new technology and people are working on. I don't worry too much. I think we can solve those problems. What I worry about is the things that are related to climate change and what's happening that we don't know about, that we're not anticipating, that's going to hit our systems.
Got it. And as you mentioned, the growth in customers such as data centers, but we're also going to add a lot of additional generation that we're going to be needed when everybody goes electric. So right now, you know, only a few thousand people drive EVs. You know, only a few thousand or a million people have heat pumps, but eventually everybody's going to drive an EV, everybody's going to have a heat pump, everything is going to be electric. That's a significant additional load. And, you know, utilities say that they need a ton more renewables, like PGE, 3,500 to 4,500 megawatts of new renewable energy to avoid capacity issues by 2030. How do you add that amount of renewable energy plus the transmission lines, which take such a long time and are so difficult to add, you know, to serve both the clean energy mandates, so the fact that the utility has to produce all clean energy, and the additional load from EVs, heat pumps, data centers, and whatever else may come our way? Like, just how do you add that and not send the rates soaring?
Well, the first thing to remember, all that new load pays a rate, so it brings money with it. So we're not in a system that's growing, has new revenues coming in that can help pay those costs. You're right. Load growth is requiring we build new resources. Now one of the questions becomes, if we didn't build renewable resources to meet that new load, could we do it cheaper through gas or coal or fossil fuels? And there's no evidence of that. In fact, the volatility of gas costs, the high cost of coal mining in this day and retrofitting and cleaning up coal plants means it's almost assured that serving this load with renewable energy is going to be cheaper than the alternative. That doesn't mean that it won't affect rates, but it does mean that if you have a new load coming on, we've got to look at the most cost-effective way to serve that. And even without our clean energy laws, it would probably be renewable energy that we would be investing in to serve that. We also need to make sure that we're getting rate structures correct. A server farm should be paying the costs of serving them. We shouldn't be subsidizing Amazon. We shouldn't be subsidizing Facebook. We shouldn't be subsidizing Apple as residential customers. The cost of that new load coming on the system should be allocated to that new load, and not we shouldn't be asking other people to pick it up. So we've got to get those sorts of things right. But it is a challenge. There is a lot of resources that are going to have to be brought on in the next decade. On some of the new growth, EVs are load that if it's done properly, it's fairly flexible. I have an EV that I plug in at night. Where there's less demand on the system. I program my car to charge at night. You can also have, and PGE is doing an experiment where they've got a bunch of EVs signed up where the utility manages the charging. So as the wind goes up and down at night, the charging goes up and down. And so the EVs are actually helping to integrate and manage renewables, because you have intermittent resources coming onto the grid and you have flexible load on the grid. And those things complement each other really, really well. So EVs can be helpful on the grid at times. The heat pumps and how do we manage the electrification of some of the heating load and the movement from natural gas, burning fossil fuels to heat your home to electricity. There's a challenge there, but I think the most important thing when it comes to, in my mind, the heat pumps is to recognize that an electric customer converting from resistance heat to a heat pump creates room for a couple gas customers to convert to a heat pump. If a heat pump is three times as clean as a resistance heat, then putting in a heat pump where there's resistant heat creates room for new. So part of what we have to do is make sure we're not just focused on new customers, on gas conversions, but our movement to get heat pumps installed in homes is also including electric homes and folks with expensive electric resistance heating are getting the benefits of those low-cost heat pumps and lowering their monthly bills and creating the room on the grid for a gas conversion.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this brings me to another sort of unpacking another piece of the pie of these high rate increases, which is usage and efficiency. So another reason why customers' bills may be going up significantly is that their usage is increasing and their, and for some of them, their equipment isn't very efficient. So some of that is linked to extreme weather. When it's very, very cold, obviously we use our heating equipment a lot more. When it's very, very hot, we're using our air conditioners. But then, the rates are, how much people are paying is very different for somebody who's got an efficient heat pump to versus somebody, like you mentioned, who has the resistance heating. So I guess I'm just wondering, is CUB supportive of programs to help customers reduce those costs, either through some energy efficiency measures, home energy retrofits, by making homes more insulated, and also this teaching customers how to conserve energy?
Oh, yes, we are and we have been for decades. And this is a place where I don't think people realize the success we've had in the Pacific Northwest. The average household uses more than 20% less electricity today than they did when I started in this job. Energy use per capita has gone down. Electric use has gone down. Natural gas use has gone down because we've invested in energy efficiency. We've retrofitted homes. We've insulated homes. We push for new equipment. We have a whole series of programs and have for decades. And a lot of states have done that at times when suddenly they have a problem with demand, they'll invest in energy efficiency, and then when that goes away, they stop doing it. And that just doesn't work. You've got to do this on a continuous cycle, because once if suddenly you've got a constraint and energy efficiency would be a good resource, you've got to start that resource 10 years earlier. You've got to build into that resource. You've got to invest into that resource. So that the fact that we use 20% less than we used to, and most of the country uses more energy than they used to. So it's not where we're doing something more than everyone else. We're going in a different direction in the Pacific Northwest and have been for two decades than the rest of the country. And that makes a real difference. We have less gas plants. We have less coal plants. We have less investment that we have to pay off in the energy system. And that keeps our rates lower. It also, because we use less, our bills are lower. When you upgrade your home, when you invest in energy efficiency, your bill directly goes down, and your comfort level goes down. Your health can improve. So in investing in energy efficiency is going to be one of the keys to meeting our climate challenges in an affordable manner. And it's really, really important. Again, we've done great things in this region, but it's time to not take the foot off the gas. We need to keep doing it and part of the reason it doesn't get highlighted as much is we've been doing it so long and so successfully. I think it's just taken for granted in the background. But we shouldn't do that. We really need to recognize energy efficiency investment is one of the best bangs for the buck that we get out there on our energy systems.
Interesting. And you partially answered my next question, which is, energy affordability isn't obviously limited to Oregon. There's utility customers in other states also seeing significant increases. But, from what I know, Oregon's rates are, like you mentioned, some of the lowest. I guess I'm wondering if, how we compare to others in rates, and it sounds like we're going in the right direction.
Right, I think we have to be careful about comparing state rates to state rates because we don't pay state rates; we pay utility rates. And again, we have two kinds of utilities here. We have investor-owned utilities and we have consumer-owned utilities. The consumer-owned utilities are largely fueled from Bonneville, from federal hydropower is their primary resource, which is really low-cost hydro. So that brings our state average down. Our investor-owned utilities, the PGE Pacific or Idaho Power, their rates are lower than the national average, but not by that much. They're quickly approaching the national average if they keep raising rates the way they are. So I do think the assumption that our rates are lower than the rest of the country, we have to be careful with that. If we don't manage our rates well, if we don't invest in efficiency and make the right investments, we're gonna lose that advantage.
Got it. I want to go back for a moment to PGE's recent 18% rate hike, because I've heard from many an outraged customer, some people are seeing really high bills, $400, $500 per month, you know, bills that have doubled. One guy actually had over $1,000 bill that he compared to a mortgage. He said he's never seen a bill like that before. You know, some people are seeing smaller increases of $30, $40. I guess I'm wondering why some folks are seeing such steep increases. Is there something in the way that the bills are calculated or things that are adding up that are the reason why the increases are so high?
Right. There's a couple of reasons. One is the rate increase combined with cold weather. The other issue is PG has really, really poor bill design, where it's hard for people to even know what their rate increase was. On the first issue is we've been warning the PUC and utilities for several years that some of these big rate hikes that they have, and they always raise rates in winter. The rates tend to change in either November or January for customers. So they always change just as we approach the winter or in the middle of winter. And that we've been warning for years that one of these times we're going to have a big rate change that's also going to come with at the time of an Arctic chill. And it's going to have devastating impacts on customers. When the weather gets really cold, your bill goes up a lot. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot more energy to heat your home when it's 20 degrees out than when it's 40 or 50. Making up that additional time for 24 hours a day is just a huge amount of energy that's running through your house. So you have a cold spell like we did for a week in January, and bills are going to shoot up. You add to that an 18% rate increase, and it really becomes real difficult. And customers weren't prepared for it. Customers weren't prepared for the fact that they have the potential for really, really high bills. And then in PGE's case, it was made more difficult. And we were getting lots of calls from people saying, I'm looking at my bill. They say it's an 18% increase, but look, my energy charge went up 30%. My transmission charge went up 19%. Yeah. My distribution went up 20-some. This thing, this can't possibly add up to 18%.
That's exactly what I've been hearing.
Right. And I've been doing this work for decades. I know how to read a utility bill. I literally had to create a spreadsheet and list out the charges line by line to figure out what's going on. And what's happening is, yes, energy charges went up by more than 30%. Different elements of your bill went up a significant amount, but one line item on your bill completely dropped off. And that was what's called Schedule 125. It's the energy update. It's really the difference between base energy charges that are set in a general rate case like we just finished and the costs that PGE is incurring. So next year, there'll be a charge for it. But this year, because we set the base, means that gets reset to zero. So there was one charge that went down to zero. And when you include that charge in, but look at somebody's bill, they can't tell that it's again, I've been doing this for decades, and I was able to say, oh, that charge is from December, not from January. Therefore, I know that this cost dropped off in January. No customer or most customers aren't going to be able to figure that out from the bill. So bad bill design really made it impossible for folks to figure out how much the rates really went up. When I sat down with my bill, my calculation did come up to 18%, but it took me time. I had to do a spreadsheet to get to that answer, and we shouldn't ever be in a situation where customers need a spreadsheet to understand what they're being charged by a utility. That's just insane.
What about the fixed charge on those bills? Did that go up as well? I know some of the utilities have been raising those fixed charges, and that actually goes up more for folks who don't use as much energy, strangely enough.
But the fixed cost charges went up for customers. The utilities tend to charge a different fixed cost for single-family homes than multifamily homes, because it takes less effort, less equipment to hook up a multifamily home per household. Those went up. Those really, and people were looking at those on their bill and saying, look, this thing went up this amount, but on your bill, you can't. The fixed charge, because it's then prorated over the number of days, you can't really, from seeing a before and after, you can't tell without knowing how many days of your billing period was in December and how many days were in January. So, but the fixed charges did go up. When we talk about an 18% increase, that included the fixed costs change, but it didn't go up as dramatically as some of the other costs.
Got it. Okay, so don't try to read your utility bill, essentially, or you'll get very frustrated.
Or we should redesign the bill so the bill gives customers good information. It's the real issue. The message shouldn't be don't read this because it tells you bad information. The real issue is, how do we get good information to customers so they understand what they're being charged?
Absolutely. And I should add that PGE, perhaps in response to this customer outrage, just expanded its income qualified bill discount program. It's now going to provide up to a 60% monthly energy discount to customers who qualify based on income. So folks should definitely inquire about that if you have a high bill and you are income qualified. And Pacific Power also has a similar program. I guess one thing I'm wondering is, do ratepayers also pay for the cost of these bill discount programs?
Yes. The bill discount programs are the legislature passed a law requiring these. They aren't coming out of the generosity of utilities. They're coming from direction from the legislature. And to me, they're important. It's in Oregon. We care about our neighbors. We don't want people living without electricity. And we've heard horrible stories over the years. I once got a call from an emergency medical technician who went to an elderly person's home, and that person had hypothermia because they were trying to get through the winter without heat. And again, that shouldn't be happening in the 21st century. So what we do is we allow low income customers who have are qualified by their income to get reduced utility bills by looking at what's their energy burden, how much of their income goes to their energy, and give them different discounts. And then we spread that cost over all ratepayers. So the impact on you or me is pretty small, but the impact on our neighbors, on our the families that are struggling, that are undergoing hardship, the effect on those folks are dramatic, because they can keep the lights on, they can afford medicine, they can afford food. It makes a huge difference. The one caveat I have with those programs is there's lots of eligible people who don't know about them, who haven't signed up. And so we have to be careful about assuming, because those programs exist, affordability is no longer a problem. There's a lot of folks struggling to pay their bills with those programs or not. And so we have to be careful about just assuming that solves the problem. We can just raise rates without worrying about the impact anymore, because as well as there's a lot of folks who live paycheck to paycheck, may have high medical costs, may have other things going on in their life, but aren't income qualified. It's the problem isn't their income. The problem is they've had huge expenses that they've got to deal with, and a big rate hike is still hard for them to absorb. Those are great programs. We encourage everyone, if you're struggling, if you think you may qualify, call your utility, find out. But we also want to be caution people that those programs don't mean energy affordability is no longer an issue for customers.
Hmm. Absolutely. That's a great point. I think the last question I would like to ask you is, you know, you mentioned a few flaws with regulations and also with the way that utility bills are written. You know, there's a sort of a conundrum at the heart of the problem that investor-owned utilities don't necessarily have an incentive to keep rates low. They have an incentive to spend money. And your organization has been advocating for changes in some of the regulations. And I'm wondering if you can maybe talk about the most important policy changes that you'd like to see in how utilities deal with these rates and their investments.
No, I'd be glad to. When I started doing this work, utility rate making was much more straightforward. A utility would come in, ask for a rate hike. The PUC, along with input from people like me, would decide how much the utility rate should go. They would set a new utility rate, and then that would be it. The utility is expected to live with that rate until they had enough cost increases that it was starting to erode their profit margin, and they were they needed to come back in to restore reasonable returns. That's not the way it operates anymore. A PG got a big rate hike. They got one the year before. Their rates have gone up 30%, and what happens? Their costs change, and they immediately file a deferral. So they can track costs. It's not where they allow cost changes to start to erode their earnings. Well before there's any erosion of earnings, they're asking for deferrals. They want to defer the storm-related costs so they can later put those in rates. They're about to file another rate case because new costs are coming in, and they want to get those. So we've moved out of this idea that we establish rates and utilities live with those. And that's a really important thing to get, a really important change, because regulation, utilities are monopolies. They're not subject to a competitive market. Regulation is supposed to impose the discipline of a competitive market. If you're a business out in the competitive market and your costs change, you can't just go and change your price because you're competing against other people. The price is largely set by the market, and you have to adjust your cost structures. You have to adjust your CEO pay. You have to reduce profits. You have to prioritize. You have to do things to try to manage your costs within the prices you can charge. And because we've gotten away from sort of holistic rate making, that's no longer the case. For the utilities, it's all about cost recovery. The PUC's job is to allow them to recover their costs, not set reasonable prices for customers. And because of it, we have single issue rate making. So if a new cost comes in, the utility is going to come in and ask for recovery of that cost on an individual basis. The utilities are allowed to update some costs after the commission's already considered and issued a final order in a docket. That to me is amazing. The commission doesn't know the final price increase when it makes a decision in a rate case. Utilities get to hide information. They're talking about, I mean, PGE kept filing updates on what its cost increase was going to be this January, and I couldn't tell people. I couldn't prepare people for the cost increase that was coming, because they're saying their forecast of a cost increase is confidential. Those things just really undercut the ability for us to have an honest conversation about what's the affordable rate. Is that what's coming, and what can we do about it? The commission has tools it can use to manage this, to reduce rate shock, to spread rate increases out. But we're not focused on rates. We're focused on cost recovery, and that just creates a much different world. And quite frankly, it's not working. In my mind, I don't want to. I don't think it's too dramatic to say that we've sort of corrupted the rate making process to the point that it doesn't work really for customers anymore. That doesn't mean anyone's. I'm not saying any individual is. I think the process has been corrupted to the point that it's no longer about setting just and reasonable rates, which is a legal standard. It's now about giving utility cost recovery for every dollar that they spend, and that's not the right approach.
Got it. Would we need legislation to change that, or does the commission, the PUC, have already tools that would allow it to make changes?
The commission has tools that allow it to make changes. That they have some pretty broad authority. On the other hand, if we can't do it through the commission, the legislature passed a law a few years ago that said landlords can't increase prices more than rent more than 10% above the rate of inflation in a year. It may be that we ought to go to the legislature and ask them to say utilities can't raise rates more than 10% above inflation in a year. If we can't get discipline from the utilities, if we can't get discipline from the regulatory process, then I think it is appropriate to go to the legislature and say you've got to impose some sort of structure that provides some sort of market discipline so utilities are constrained by the prices they charge just like any other business.
Absolutely. Bob, this has been a really important and fascinating conversation, and we're going to be following this topic in the future. I'm sure there's going to be more rate increases to write about and analyze. So I'll drop a few links to some of the things that you mentioned in the show notes. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to Beat Check with the Oregonian. If you like this show, please give us a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find the show. The best way to support our journalism and stories like this is with a subscription to Oregon Live. You can do that at oregonlive.com/podsupport. Until next time.